What I'm going to do is give a bit of a talk now, and the subject tonight is karma and rebirth, but subtitled by Kalyanatara, the Buddhist teaching that actions have consequences. So we'll see how we get on. And I'd like to give a talk and then have some time for just a bit of discussion, see what comes out of it for you, and then a tea break in a time-honoured fashion. And then hopefully time for a slightly longer meditation afterwards. And I like to do it that way around, because then you get a bit of space or time to digest anything that comes up for you in the talk. And then end the evening in a more kind of reflective state of mind. And then finish about 9:30. And off we go. So karma and rebirth... It's a big subject, actually. It's a big subject. But it's a really, really central topic to Buddhism. So I think any kind of interest in understanding Buddhism, you've got to kind of get to grips with karma and rebirth. And it's been central to Buddhism right from the very beginning. But also, the Buddha kind of had some warnings about it. So I want to start off with a couple of quotes from the Buddhist scriptures, if you like, the Buddhist sutras, just kind of describing how the Buddha first articulated his experience of enlightenment. Then also one of the two of the things he said about it subsequently. And then talk more, I don't know, from my own reflections or own experience or modern issues, that kind of thing, bring it up to date. So I personally like the old stories of the Buddha. Very often they're stories of him meeting people, almost at random. He kind of wandered around North India, bumping into people at random, and then having whatever kind of conversation came next. And some of them, not this particular one, but some of them are so kind of quirky, you think they must be true, almost like you couldn't make it up. And also, it's so clear that human nature is just the same now as it ever was then. So I like the stories. But this particular one is a bit more abstract, but it just locates, you know, the Buddhist kind of teaching of karma right at the beginning. But actually, one thing I want to say first is that karma is actually only an aspect of a wider, more fundamental Buddhist teaching. So that's what I want to explore first. So the wider, more fundamental teaching is known as the principle of conditionality, the principle that things arise independent on conditions. And it's pretty much that insight that made the Buddha a Buddha. So anyway, let me read this and see how we get on. So, what it says is, I have heard that on one occasion, when the Blessed One was newly awakened, that is, newly enlightened, still staying at Uruvela, which is Bodh Gaya, by the banks of the Naranjana River, which is still there, in the shade of the Bodhi tree, which is not still there, but some kind of descendant of the Bodhi tree is meant to be still there, the tree of awakening. He sat in the shade of the Bodhi tree for 7 days in one session, sensitive to the bliss of release. So he just got enlightened, and he was still kind of absorbing it, and still sitting there, just kind of digesting what had happened. The stories are that he stayed there for 7 weeks, I think. So this is one of those weeks. Anyway, he sat in the shade of the Bodhi tree for 7 days in one session. At the end of 7 days, after emerging from that concentration, in the first watch of the night, he gave close attention to the principle of conditionality. Thus, this being that becomes, from the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. Then on realizing its significance, the Lord uttered on that occasion this inspired utterance. When things become manifest to the ardent meditating Brahman, he abides scattering Mara's host, like the sun illumining the sky. So that's a funny little quote. It's kind of half a formula, you know, this being that becomes, and half a kind of bit of inspired poetry. And the Buddhist scriptures often alternate a bit between those two modes, if you like. And I think that kind of does justice to how it was. partly the Buddha had a genuine insight into how things work, quite practically, how things work. And partly that insight was just deeply, deeply inspiring for him. He abides scattering Mara's host. Mara's the kind of Buddhist demon of distraction, if you like. The Lord of Limitations, he's called. Scattering Mara's host like the sun illumining the sky. Anyway, it locates this principle of insight into conditionality right at the beginning of the Buddha's career of being a Buddha. And I want to give another example, and this time it comes from the very end of the Buddha's life. So fast forward 40 years. He's had a whole career of meeting people, talking, giving teachings, building up a bit for following. He's now an old man of 80, and he knows he is approaching his final days, and he's trying to sum up his teaching for the benefit of his disciples in the most succinct possible way for their future benefit. So what he does is he goes on tour, visiting group after group after group all over northern India, giving the same teaching again and again and again. And I'll just read out a bit of the story from one of these encounters. So it says, the Blessed One, when he was living at Rajgriha, at the hill called Vulture's Peak, which is still there, you can go there, often he gave counsel to the bhikkhus thus, such and such is virtue, such and such is meditative concentration, and such is wisdom. Great becomes the fruit, great the gain of meditative concentration when it is fully developed by virtuous conduct. Great becomes the fruit, great the gain of wisdom when it is fully developed by meditative concentration. Utterly freed from the taints of lust, becoming and ignorance is the mind that's fully developed in wisdom. So that's a slightly clunky kind of translation, but I've got a feeling religious translations often are. They seem to kind of be in that mode. But the interesting thing is, this is the same teaching as the first one, although it might not sound the same. But what it is, it's a much more specific application of the general law. So the first one, when he's sitting under the Bodhi tree, he's kind of describing a very, very general law. This being, that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. And now, when he's at the end of his life, he's focusing on one particular application of it. He's basically saying, if you want total freedom from lust, becoming and ignorance, you need a mind fully developed in wisdom. So wisdom leads to freedom. But then he's saying, if you want wisdom, you need meditative concentration. So meditative concentration leads to wisdom, leads to freedom. Then he's saying, if you want meditative concentration, you need virtue, a kind of virtuous life. So you get this little sequence. Virtue is the foundation for meditative concentration. Meditative concentration is the foundation for wisdom. Wisdom is the foundation for freedom. It's like A leads to B, leads to C, leads to D. So that's one example of a little chain of actions and consequences which the Buddha chose to focus on again and again and again at the very end of his life. And that's often called the threefold path, ethics, meditation and wisdom, sila, samadhi and pranaya. And it's pretty much the simplest formulation you can get of the Buddha's path. But it's just an application of this more general principle of conditionality. And you can almost look at your experience and find hundreds of examples of the way things arise in dependence on other things. It's not like it's a secret. It's kind of common sense. But it's not common sense that we live by. One example often comes to my mind is gardening. If you want flowers, you need seeds. Independence on seeds arises flowers. But you can't just have seeds to flowers. You might need soil, then seeds, then watering, then flowers. A little kind of chain of actions and consequences in that sort of way. If you want, a career, you need job application, job interview, job, next job, and so on and so on. So things arise in dependence on conditions, but not at random, but according to quite particular kind of laws, almost, of cause and effect. And a big word in Buddhism is skillfulness. You can become skilled. And Buddhism teaches not so much that there's sin and the absence of sin, but there's skillfulness and unskillfulness. And skillfulness is understanding the way things work, what you need to put into condition, what conditions you need to put into place to give rise to the outcome you want. And then the way that gives rise to further outcomes and so on. And you can just become skilled in pretty much every area of life by the use of intelligent examination of your experience, appropriate learning to other people who are more experienced, a certain amount of trial and error, and so on. One thing I like about Buddhism is that the Buddha was very open to trial and error. If you read his life story, he tried all sorts of things, and quite a few of them went wrong. So before he was enlightened, he was trying all kinds of things. But they didn't lead, to the freedom he desired. And it took him quite a while to discover, what the appropriate conditions were giving rise to his enlightenment. So I want to give one more quote from the Buddhist scriptures, and then go on to explore it in a bit more detail. So the general principle is conditionality. Things arise independence on conditions. And that's what sometimes it's called a universal law of conditionality, because frankly everything arises independence on conditions. Buddhism would say there is nothing which doesn't come under that big overall umbrella. Nothing. But when you speak about it, it can sound very simple. So here's a little quote from this time involving Ananda. And Ananda was the Buddha's faithful attendant for maybe 25 years. He just lived with the Buddha, served the Buddha, worked for the Buddha, followed the Buddha around, listened to the Buddha's teaching for 25 years, probably longer. And the interesting thing is he never got enlightened in all that time. So you have to imagine him a very kind of faithful, dedicated chap, but not quite getting it. Anyway, so the Venerable Ananda went into the presence of the Exalted One and, saluting him, sat down at one side. So seated, he said to the Exalted One, "Wonderful Lord, marvellous Lord, is the depth of this causal law, which I've just been talking about, and how deep it appears. And yet, I reckon it is ever so plain," says Ananda. But the Buddha replies, "Say not so, Ananda, say not so. Deep indeed is this causal law, and deep indeed it appears. But it is through not knowing, not understanding, not penetrating this doctrine that this generation has become entangled like a ball of string and covered with blight, like munja grass, whatever that is, unable to overpass the doom of the waste, whatever that is, the woeful way, the downfall. In him, Ananda, who contemplates the enjoyment of all that makes for grasping, craving grows. Grasping is conditioned by craving, and in the same way, becoming, birth, decay and death and suffering all come to pass. Such is the uprising of this entire mass of ill." So Ananda's saying, this is a great teaching, but it's pretty simple really. And the Buddha is saying, this is a great teaching, and it's not so simple really. And the Buddha is also saying that people don't live by it. That's the crucial thing, they don't live by it. And because they don't live by it, actions continue to have consequences, but leading them further and further away from happiness and deeper into suffering. And he gives this example of almost like another chain of actions and consequences, but this time leading people deeper into suffering. And the chain he gives is, first of all, contemplating the enjoyment of all that makes for grasping, which I take to mean kind of fantasizing or like window shopping, that kind of thing. where you're just endlessly dreaming about what you want next. And then out of that comes grasping. Then out of that comes becoming, where you kind of get it, and you can merge with the thing you want, the thing you've craved. Then out of that comes what he says here is decay and death, because the thing you crave is impermanent. It never lasts, so you never quite get any lasting satisfaction. Then out of that comes suffering. So there's a kind of chain of fantasizing, fantasizing, craving, grasping, getting, decay and death, you know, breakdown, if you like, and then suffering. So the same law happens, but it can lead you in the direction of enlightenment through ethics, to meditation, to wisdom, to freedom, or it can lead you in the direction of more and more entanglement in samsara, you know, by fantasizing, craving, grasping, etc. So, and I think many Buddhist teachings are quite easy to kind of get in theory, but many people don't live them in practice, and that's the crucial distinction. You know, it can make sense, and you can nod, and you can say yes, in theory, but what matters is what we live by, what truths we actually live by. So, yeah, I want to go on and talk about karma as a more particular application of this. But first of all, I think this law of conditionality really is the kind of foundational insight of the Buddha's enlightenment. And although it sounds quite abstract, this being that becomes from the arising of this that arises, and it might not sound like much, I think it's what underpins pretty much all the other major Buddhist teachings. So I just want to spend a few minutes kind of dwelling on that. So the formula that came up in the first quote was, this being that becomes, from the arising of this that arises. This not being that does not become, from the ceasing of this that ceases. It's a funny sort of quasi-mathematical formula. But what it says is that things, stuff, are brought into being by conditions, this being that becomes. Nothing is sort of spontaneously generated. Things only exist because conditions produce them. Then it says things only endure because supportive conditions support them. So taking us as an example, our life endures because of all sorts of conditions. The air around us, the food we eat, you know, the absence of toxic whatevers. So we're brought into being by conditions and we endure by conditions. And if those conditions are not there, you know, the thing itself, whether it's us or anything else, simply passes away. Therefore, we get the Buddhist teaching of impermanence. Nothing is permanent. Nothing is kind of fixed. Because to be fixed, you'd have to be outside that whole flow. But nothing is outside that whole flow. Everything is part of it. Everything is brought into being by conditions, sustained by conditions, and so on. Therefore, sooner or later, everything passes away. Another Buddhist teaching, which comes directly out of it, is interconnectedness. Everything is connected by these chains of causes and conditions. For something to be not interconnected, it would have to be completely insulated from any kind of conditions bringing it into being or sustaining it. And it just couldn't kind of interact with the rest of reality. It would be like some strange kind of black hole. Which may exist, it's true, but they're a long way away if they do. Another teaching that comes directly out of it is anatta, which is non-selfhood. So most religions have some kind of doctrine that somewhere inside us is some kind of soul or spirit or something, you know, which is sort of our permanent essence. And if you're a Christian, you know, it goes to heaven when you die and lives in bliss ever after. And if you're Hindu, it kind of hops into the next body and, you know, that's your new life or whatever. But Buddhism teaches instead anatta, which is non-selfhood, which simply says there's nothing unchanging and permanent about us. There's nothing fixed in that way, which comes directly out of Pratityasamutpada. So Buddhism says we do have an identity, you know, I am me and you are you, but it's constantly, slowly evolving as we grow older, as things happen, as we do what we do. And there's nothing about it that's fixed, because it's subject to this universal law of conditions and interconnectedness. So the quote says, this being that becomes, and so on, which makes it sound a bit like one object causes another object. And I think that's misleading, and you get into this misleading territory partly because of language. Language just is made up of nouns and verbs, this and that. But I think a much better metaphor is kind of more fluid metaphors. So I was thinking today of a river. When you think of a river, it flows. And it flows because every single particle in that river is kind of pushed in some way, some complicated way, by all the particles next to it, which are themselves pushed by whatever particles of river are next to it. And then the whole thing kind of moves along. And I think that's a great metaphor for reality, if you like. And then we and everything else are just bits of that river. And when you think of a river, it's not made up of discrete bits. There's no lumps in a river. There's just water. And you could say water is made of drops. But if you look again, if you look at a river, there's no division between one drop and another drop. There's just water. So when we look around the world, it kind of looks a bit like the world comes in bits. There's a me bit and a you bit and a you bit and so on and so on. But the boundaries between our bits are much more arbitrary than we would like to think. And so the more we can think in terms of this metaphor of interconnectedness and flow and non-selfhood, I think the closer we are to how things really are. And I think when you look at your experience really deeply, it's very hard to answer the question of what is uniquely me. Like, I know very well a lot of my most cherished views come from others. They're only in my head because somebody put them there, probably giving some talk or reading some book sometime in the past. So I think of them as my opinions, but they've only come to me because of my connections with others, and so on. All your skills, all your talents probably came to you from teachers who taught you whatever they taught you years back. So they're not really you, and you can't really draw a boundary around them and say, this is me, this belongs to me. They come to you through others. So anyway, non-selfhood comes pretty directly out of conditionality. So anyway, karma is part of that. So the Buddhist teaching of karma is that actions have consequences, and that karma literally means action. Okay? But it means action in a particular way. In the teaching of karma, it's not just action. It's the actions you take, which are conscious and deliberate and volitional, and you've chosen them. Okay? And that's only some of our actions. Because some stuff you do, you know, without quite intending it. Like you breathe in and out. It's not exactly karmic. It's more mechanical. But some things we do, it's a very definite choice. And because we've made that choice, that's the type of action we're talking about when we're talking about the law of karma. Now, what Buddhism says is that these actions are conscious, intentional, willed, volitional actions have a very profound effect on us going forwards. So if you habitually indulge in certain types of thoughts, you'll just become that kind of person. I gave the example before about, kind of fantasizing and then craving and then grasping and then becoming. So if you spend your time in that kind of world, fantasizing about getting this or that, or fantasizing about destroying this or that, or about, you know, whatever it might be, you kind of become that kind of person. So independence on this arises that. And your character is just shaped by your karmic actions, which include your thoughts. So thoughts are an action just as much as speech and bodily actions. So going forwards, we are kind of shaped by our karmic willed, volitional, intentional actions. And I think that's relatively clear. But I think where the teaching of karma becomes dangerous or easy to misunderstand is that you can look at it backwards as well. So in the present moment, here we are. This is me and that's you. And we've all got a past. And our past includes a whole bunch of karmically significant actions. And what Buddhism and the whole of the East says is that obviously we've got the karmic actions of our life, our present life. So I'm 57, I've got 57 years worth of karmic actions behind me. But it also says we have an enormous number of past lives where we were some kind of person, but still doing karmic actions. And sometimes you get stories of the Buddha in his past life. And he's doing this and he dies and he goes forwards and he's another person and he goes forwards and he's another person. And the Dalai Lama, for instance, is the 14th Dalai Lama. So you get biographies of all the previous Dalai Lamas. And they can kind of trace, you know, your whole sequence of different lives. So the teaching of karma for Buddhism and in the East generally says that you are who you are now as a result of all your karmic actions going backwards for this life and many lives. And that may or may not be true, but it opens the door to huge misunderstandings, I think. So I want to kind of dwell on that, because I think it's really important to understand it going forwards. Because in the present moment, here we all are, but looking around the world, some people are in very, very difficult circumstances. So some people are oppressed in various ways. We're living in situations which are really oppressive. Some people are physically or mentally suffering in different ways, physically handicapped, mentally ill, whatever, whatever. Some people have terrible things happen to them, physically, mentally, whatever, whatever. Some MP got shot today, for instance, it was on the news. So bad stuff happens. And then the question arises, why are these people in these situations and why do bad things happen to certain people? Why? By contrast, some people seem to have happy lives and good things happen to them. They win the lottery or something. So then, Buddhism would say that things happen to people. Things which happen always have causes. Nothing happens at random. There's always a cause. So if you happen to be in a very, you know, discriminated or oppressive situation, there will be a cause to that. Or if you're disabled in some way or suffering in some way, there will be a cause to that. But the question is, what kind of causes might they be? And some schools of Eastern thought attribute all your suffering to karmic actions of yours in the past. Basically saying it's always your responsibility. It's always fully your responsibility. So I'll give you a couple of examples to show you what I mean. There was one quite famous one a few years ago where an English football coach, a guy called Glenn Hoddle, was sacked unceremoniously from his job as English football coach because he gave an interview to the Times basically saying that disabled people had clearly done bad things in a previous life. And they'd come back here to you know, to kind of suffer and hopefully get over it. So I'll read you what he said, just because it's an example of this kind of view. So he says, you and I have been physically given two hands and two legs and half-decent brains. That's what he says. Some people have not been born like that. That's clearly true. But he goes on to say, some people have not been born like that for a reason. The karma is working from another lifetime. What you sow, you have to reap. Therefore, if you've been born without two arms or without two legs or without a half-decent brain, that's your karma, your ethically, you know, culpable responsibility from another lifetime. You sowed it in the past and you're reaping it in the present. In other words, you deserve it. So that provoked a huge storm in the British media, and he got sacked. He had to, or he resigned, I can't remember. But it also provoked a whole bunch of Eastern commentators commentating on it. So I'll just give you one. So this is a professor from Canada, but Hindu professor, and he says, "When I encountered disability, how, from my Hindu perspective, should I react? True, according to the laws of karma and reincarnation, the disability is necessarily a result of some past action." So he's saying exactly the same thing. The disability is necessarily the result of a past action in the previous life. So some Hindus staunchly stood by it, you know. And he wasn't saying you should be horrible to these disabled people, but he's definitely saying it's their fault. So there can be a view that people in suffering circumstances must have done karmically weighty actions in the past to cause their present suffering. Okay. And this definitely comes up in Buddhism too. I'm embarrassed to say it, but it is true. But there are aspects, sections of the Buddhist community which have the same sort of view. So I haven't got that many quotes from it, but Tibetan Buddhists particularly have this kind of view. I'll give you one, English one. So when Buddhism was quite new to Britain in the 1940s, there was a guy called Christmas Humphreys, who was very influential, actually. He was the chairman or president of the Buddhist Society in London at the time that Sangrakshita was just coming back from the East and just starting to teach. So he wrote a book, interestingly, called Karma and Rebirth. And I'll give you a quote from this book, Karma and Rebirth, by Christmas Humphreys, president of the Buddhist Society in London. He says, "Cripples, dwarfs, and those born deaf or blind are the products of their own past actions." Full stop. "One's pity should be used not in bewailing the injustice of their conditions, not in that, but in assisting the newborn to appreciate their own responsibility." In other words, get used to the fact they deserved it, "and to produce new causes whose result will be the undoing of the evil whose results are manifest." So these cripples, dwarves, and those born deaf or blind must have done evil in the past, and these are the manifest results. So that's pretty heavy duty, but it's in a book called Karma and Rebirth by Christmas Humphreys. So, and I looked all this up on the internet to get the actual verbatim quotes today, just to make sure I got my facts right. And I think, slightly in his defence, he wrote it a bit before he became a full Buddhist, because originally the Buddhist Society was a kind of Hindu, a branch of Hinduism, a branch of the Theosophical Society. But nevertheless, he wrote this book, and this is what he said. So that kind of view, it doesn't take much imagination to see it can legitimise all kinds of indifference or even, collusion in, perpetuating injustice. And I think the biggest example of this is the Hindu caste system. So in India, there's been a caste system for 2,000 years, 2,500 years, where people are born into one or another caste. And there's four or five main castes and about 2,000 subcastes. And you're just born into your caste and that's the end of it. And there's no possibility whatsoever of changing your caste. And you just go through the generations being this caste or that caste. But they're very hierarchical, and there's an absolute difference in kind of levels between the castes and the the attitude people have towards higher caste or lower caste people. But and the very bottom of this whole system is a large number of people, I think it's currently around 100 million people in India who are below the bottom official rung of the caste system. So the bottom rung officially is the Shudras, who are the labourers, which is fairly menial. At least they have a job, so to speak. But below that is the untouchables, who were considered so polluting just because of their birth into the caste system, that they were untouchable. You couldn't touch them without being polluted yourself and having to do all kinds of rituals. So the official Hindu view was that these people must have done bad things in a previous life, therefore they were born into the untouchable strata, and their job in this life was to endure their circumstances so as to purify themselves and have a better life next time round. So in other words, if you interfered with their circumstances and tried to be a social worker or a do-gooder, you were basically messing up their purification, and it's just going to take them longer to have a better rebirth. So the caste system in India has been very, very stable because nobody dared interfere with this kind of mechanism, but also incredibly unequal. So at the top is the Brahmins, and then you go down, down, down to the untouchables. And it's only really been shaken up big time in the last 50 or 60 years with a mass conversion to Buddhism, which is a whole story, which I won't go into. But it's an example of how this kind of view that can legitimise, ongoing inequality and indifference and injustice. Interestingly, one of the first big crack in the this whole edifice was that the British colonial government welcomed untouchables into the army. They wanted soldiers, they didn't really care who they got. They welcomed the untouchables into the army and taught them a whole bunch of military skills, which gave them confidence, you know, to fight for their, stick up for themselves, basically. And that was the kind of seed that just started giving the untouchables the confidence to basically fight back. And it was never a particularly violent struggle, but it was a slow growth in confidence, culminating in conversion to Buddhism. So, I personally think that kind of view, that if you suffer today, you must have done evil in a previous life, I think that's a dreadful view. I think it's pernicious. But that it's definitely kind of alive and well as a view in some quarters today, particularly Hinduism, but partly Buddhism. But I think it's really important to understand it more clearly so that you don't fall into it yourself. So what Buddhism says, as I understand it, is that if you do bad actions, going forwards, you will become the kind of person who will suffer. So evil, greedy, hateful, whatever thoughts will just mould you into that kind of person, and you won't be happy going forwards. Okay. But if you find yourself in the present suffering from some reason or other, basically things happen for a whole bunch of reasons. And you could have done all kinds of bad stuff in the past, so you could have wound up in the present as that kind of person who's suffering, but you could have basically suffered. Your circumstances could have arisen from all sorts of other chains of cause and effect, which are not in the least morally culpable, and they're just almost like bad luck. So I want to give some examples, and then you can almost, play with it and see what you think. Are these people, do they deserve it or do they not deserve it? What sort of conditions, what kind of laws of action and reaction could have caused these people to suffer in the way they suffer? So, I've got a friend who's an order member, actually, who has been in a wheelchair for the last 40 years because he was crippled, aged 18, by jumping off some rocks into some water and smashing his legs on the rocks just under the surface. So he suddenly went from being a healthy young man to being a cripple in a wheelchair just by jumping off some rocks into shallow water which had rocks in it. you know, was that is a karmic action that he kind of deserved what he got or not? Question. I've already mentioned the whole situation of India's untouchables, or ex-untouchables as they are now, who've been in that incredibly discriminated against situation for centuries and centuries and centuries now, in a system legitimised by Hindu scripture. You know, is that their fault, or is it something else going on? Another example is in 2004 there was a tsunami, you probably remember it, which killed a huge number of people, 200,000 people or so, in the whole area of Indonesia, Sri Lanka and India. Just spread out across that part of the Indian Ocean, and vast numbers of people died. And if you Google 2004 tsunami karma, you'll get a surprising number of people on the internet saying that it was their karma that made them die, led them to die. Basically, all these hundreds of thousands of people must have done bad stuff, therefore they died. Just Google 2004 tsunami karma, and you will get some extraordinary arguments saying that this was the karmic consequence of some misdeeds they did in the past. So another question mark, you know, what was going on there? They definitely died. It was definitely major tragedies, but why? Another one is, I've got a kind of stepson, who some of you have met, a little boy called Aaron, aged 8, who's autistic and non-verbal. And a lovely boy, happy boy, but clearly something in his brain doesn't quite connect in the normal way, and he doesn't interact in quite the normal way, and he doesn't talk. So is that a karmic consequence from some previous life, or what? Question mark. And then the last example I thought of was Kalyana Tara's had a cold the last few days. And, you know, what's caused that? Is that evil from a previous life? I was thinking it could be a misspent youth. You were talking about a misspent youth there.
Definitely.
You were talking about cigarettes, weren't you?
Yes.
So anyway, it's like suffering. There's a lot of suffering in the world. And these are just a few examples. And Buddhism would definitely say things have causes. So this suffering has a causes. But are these... Are there karmically weighty, you know, actions behind all this suffering? Did people do something unskillful sometime in the past to cause their present suffering? So maybe we could just, you know, talk about that a bit when I finished. And I would say no. I would say no. I would say that Kalyanatara's cold might be caused by misspent youth, too many cigarettes, you know, it does something to your lungs. There is the consequence. I would say that Amoghavadra's wheelchair, you know, he chose to jump off that rock into that water, probably without really looking. You know, some sort of recklessness there. I wouldn't call it evil, but some sort of recklessness. I would say the people in the tsunami were just completely innocent. I mean, honestly, how could you think anything else? They were just living wherever they lived. Hey, I would say the untouchables of India have just been the victims of a massive economic and social oppression by the privileged elite for centuries. And it's not, you know, nothing to do with their past actions whatsoever. And I'd say that my stepson, Aaron, has just got something in his brain chemistry that's just not quite normal, whatever normal is. And again, nothing to do with the past life, just some sort of brain chemistry. So what Buddhism says, kind of later Buddhism took the Buddha's teachings, which were fairly informal. Like I mentioned, he just walked around India, met people, had conversations, pretty much at random. And it was all very fresh and new. But later Buddhism systematize things. That's a natural progression. Things get systematized. And it tried to systematize this universal law of conditionality into a more kind of clear mechanisms. And he came up with a teaching called the five niyamas. So a niyama is a kind of sphere of conditionality. It's a kind of a sphere of conditionality, yeah. And it basically says that you can have, there's five of these niyamas, and in each of them, completely different laws of cause and effect are in operation. So they all come under the umbrella of conditionality, but quite different things are in play. So I'll tell you briefly what they are. So the first one is called Utu Niyama. And this is basically the laws of kind of chemistry, physics and chemistry, where, you know, things come together and they react. Molecules come together and react. Or gravity, you know, makes things which go up come down. It's very kind of simple. It's physics and chemistry. It's the Earth, you know, it's planets, it's stars. It's nothing to do with consciousness. But there's all sorts of laws of physics and chemistry and science which just explain how things come to be in this level of reality. Thermodynamics, electricity, you know, physics. And so some suffering can be perfectly well explained using these natural laws. If a brick drops on your foot, it's probably gravity that kind of made it happen, not your past life misdeeds. If my stepson's brain isn't quite wired up right, it's probably something chemical going on, again, rather than anything more ethical. The next one is called Bija Niyama, which is basically the laws of biology, which is almost like physics and chemistry, but in a much more subtle, complicated realm where life appears. And, you know, things evolve. Plants, animals evolve. Again, there's nothing spiritual about it. It's just that life perpetuates itself according to natural laws. Life evolves according to natural laws. Biology, botany, physiology, etc., etc., etc. It's kind of realm of medicine as well, where you, you know, you see something going wrong and you fix it with appropriate medicine. The next one is the law is the whole sphere of the mind. So, kind of almost like above and beyond biology is the mind, consciousness, psychology, which obviously depends on biology for its continued existence, but it's a different thing again. So there's a whole science of psychology where you know, mental states arise and pass away and breed and so on and so on. And it's the realm of animals. It's the realm of instinct and response and so on. And again, none of this has any ethical weight to it. It's just natural laws working themselves out. So there's five, and the last two are where you kind of get into more the realm of karma, as meaning ethical karma. So the karma niyama is where you finally have a kind of level of reality where beings, whether human or non-human, have some degree of conscious choice. So they're not just acting out of instinct. There's some conscious choice. There's some awareness of the situation and some awareness of yourself and some awareness of possibilities. And then out of all that awareness comes choice. And it might not be very much choice because a lot of instinct still happens. But the more choice there is, the more responsibility there is. And therefore, the more karmic weight there is to your actions. And therefore, the more important it is to cultivate skillfulness versus unskillfulness. So the karma niyama is the fourth kind of level of the niyamas, which is very important, but you can see there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on as well. And then the final one is always left a bit vague. It's always left a bit mysterious. It's called the dharma niyama, which sometimes it's kind of described as the kind of space that holds all the others, a And sometimes it's described as the realm of, almost like magic. It's the realm of actions and consequences above and beyond all the rest. Sometimes it's described as the level of causality that allows Buddhas to appear, where you sort of, I don't know, you go beyond everything else. I don't think the Buddhist tradition explains it in a terribly coherent way. Sangharakshita has tried to take it forwards as definitely that level of conditionality that allows you to make spiritual progress, kind of step by step by step onwards towards the complete freedom that the Buddha talked about at the beginning, culminating in enlightenment. So these five levels of conditionality came up later in Buddhism when they were trying to get to grips with conditionality and just kind of nail it down a bit. But in doing so, they made it really clear that things in the present can arise from all sorts of types of conditionality in the past. So basically, if you're suffering here and now, there will be a cause, but you really can't tell what level of reality the cause is on. And you certainly can't assume that you were responsible for it necessarily in any kind of previous life. So Christmas Humphrey's quote about cripples and dwarfs having done evil would be completely thrown out by this view of conditionality, which I think is much, much truer to what the Buddha intended. So they might have done something terrible, but there's absolutely no way that you can assume it. So there's absolutely no way that you can pin anything on people suffering and say it's your fault, unless you've observed it for yourself really clearly, you know, because somebody's done something really stupid. So, I should finish soon. One thing I wanted to say is that all this probably sounds very dualistic, and I know some people are attracted to Buddhism on the grounds it's non-dualistic, and you kind of go beyond judgment and, you know, right and wrong. But I think the truth is, Buddhism can be described as a path, and at the beginning of the path, I think it genuinely is quite dualistic. It's quite happy to say that this is something to be cultivated and this is something not to be cultivated. This is skillful, this is not skillful. This is praiseworthy, this is blameworthy. And that unless you can kind of get clear on the, you know, which actions belong in which camp, you won't really make spiritual progress. Then you go on and on and on and on, cultivating ethics, cultivating meditation, cultivating wisdom, leading to freedom and so on. And then kind of right down the far end of the spiritual path, it's appropriate to start letting go of that dualistic framework. And by that time, your whole sense of fixed, discrete ego identity will have almost dissolved anyway. And you'll hardly be thinking of yourself as me, 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 me. There'll just be this kind of flow of action and reaction, action and consequences. And then you can kind of let go of duality, I think. So one way that's sometimes described is that there is no gift, no giver, no one to give to, yet all is perfectly given. So that's, you know, rather than me practicing generosity because that's skillful, you kind of abandon all that. There's no gift, no giver, and no one to give to, but yet all is perfectly given. Yes. So by that time, you're kind of doing all the right things completely spontaneously without even thinking about it. But at the beginning of the path, a dualistic perspective is much more appropriate. So I haven't talked at all about rebirth yet. And it's interesting, Christmas Humphrey's book was called Karma and Rebirth, and Sangharakshita's classic lecture on the subject is called Karma and Rebirth. But for me, I don't know, karma is what matters. What matters for me is the actions that we take in the present moment, here and now. And that's what will condition us going forwards. And for sure, somewhere in the future, who knows when, is death. So we will die. Buddhism says that death is certain and the time of death is uncertain. That's just two simple truths. Death is certain, the time of death is uncertain. But for me, what happens after death is equally uncertain. I just have no idea. And people want to know, and people have all kinds of opinions about it, about what happens after death and also about past lives. People have all kinds of opinions. But for me, they just remain in the realm of speculation or wishful thinking. I don't know, I probably never will know, and you just got to accept that it's a bit of a mystery. But in the present moment, it's pretty clear what is the best thing to do. You know, cultivate ethics, meditation, wisdom, and so on, and practice the path in the kind of faith that whatever comes after death, you'll be setting yourself up for the best. Yeah. I also feel that in terms of past lives, we've all landed on planet Earth in different circumstances, with different talents and different, you know, characters and different suffering or good fortune or bad fortune. But again, frankly, who knows? Who knows? You just got to kind of start from where you are and go forwards. So I personally completely reject all the notions of, you know, you brought it on yourself, particularly any notion of past life responsibility. I think you just can't go there. And you've got to go forwards, setting yourself up for the best possible fruits going forwards. So, that's a bit of a kind of whiz through karma, maybe a kind of nod at rebirth. And people have written books on the subject, and the Buddhist commentators have made it much, much, much more complicated than I've mentioned as well. They tried to get really, really kind of precise about what actions will produce what consequences. Again, I think that takes us into the realm of speculation a bit, and I think we're better to stick into more general principles. And I've always really liked the Buddha's final teaching, ethics, meditation, wisdom, freedom. Ethics, meditation, wisdom, freedom. And if you practice that, you just won't go far wrong, I don't think. So I'm going to stop there. And we could have a bit of time for discussion now, and then a cup of tea, and then a bit of meditation. How about that? Mm.